Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe. Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease. This episode is entirely concerned with zoonoses, the constant threat of infections crossing from species to us and also from species to other species, particularly because of what we do. That is, after all, what happened to start the pandemic. And in a moment, I'll be hearing about the ongoing struggles of the Chinese virologist who broke his instructions in China in order to share the first COVID genetic sequence. But also, we've got a strange tale of how tobacco growing might provide bat viruses a path into other species. And before those, the spread, which we've been talking about regularly for the past 18 months, of the highly pathogenic bird flu H5N1, which now spans from the Arctic to the Antarctic, from Asia through Europe and Africa to America, from poultry to penguins and predatory birds, from pets to mink to marine mammals, and sometimes people. On the whole, we are not so much exposed to the virus. But a month ago, we talked here about an alarming crossover into dairy herds in the USA and potentially one dairy worker. Worrying, but baffling given a lack of data. At the end of April, though, the US Department of Agriculture did a data dump of genetic sequences they'd recorded, which was immediately seized upon by international analysts, including Mike Warraby of the University of Arizona, who quickly unravelled the history of this outbreak in cows. I called Mike to get an update on the continuing growth of this outbreak and hear what those genes revealed.
So as soon as I had the genes that we could start analysing, the first thing I did was look and see that all of these cattle viruses had exactly the same constellation of gene segments. And so it was very clearly a single virus that had been transmitting within the cattle. And because we had information when some of these sequences were sampled through a window in time, you can actually calibrate a molecular clock. That clock told us that this outbreak, even though it was only really pinned down as H5N1 in late March, probably started maybe sometime December or January. And by the time we were analyzing these data now in late April, we were already maybe 5 months into this.
I mean, as I recall, the sort of the evidence that there was an issue was falling milk yields in some cows, some ill health and so on, but it sounds like that may have been going on a lot longer, but no one was reporting it.
Yeah, so those reports and the realization that there was something weird going on with a drop in milk yield, sort of thick, yellow, unusually creamy milk, that started at least as far back as February, and veterinarians were collecting samples and sending them to try to figure out what this was. And our results suggest that cattle were probably being infected even a couple of months before that. And this was just the tip of the iceberg that people finally started seeing enough of this that it caught their attention. But one of the things here that really catches my attention are the lost opportunities to realize what was happening earlier. And so in February, if those samples, rather than being subjected to tests for individual viruses, you know, let's look at this virus. Does it have it? No. Let's look at that one. Does it have it? No. And it took 3 weeks until someone thought, well, let's check for influenza, even though cattle aren't supposed to have influenza. And bang, it's H5N1 in cattle. There are techniques that if those samples had been subjected to what we call metagenomic sequencing, where you don't target any specific thing, you just sequence the heck out of all of the RNA and DNA in there, and if there's something like H5N1, it'll pop out. We could have known as far back as February, at least, that we were dealing with this and had much more of a chance to control it.
And I've lost count how many states have now been reporting it, but this is geographically really widespread. It's not even neighboring states necessarily.
That's right. Yeah, it's as far as the East Coast, it's through the Midwest and the West, and clearly a very extensive outbreak, which, again, the gene sequence data, once we had that, you know, it's a matter of minutes to see, man, this is obviously very, very widespread. And within a couple days of reading the information that the genome sequences were telling us, that was sort of confirmed by colleagues of mine who basically they drove through 10 states and bought milk off the grocery store shelves and found that 40% of them had traces of the genetic material of H5N1 in them.
This is a very important point. So RNA is being found in the milk, which clearly shows that it's getting from the udders, and they're presenting with a kind of mastitis, as I understand it. They've got an udder inflammation, which is the nature of the infection, is that right? And the virus is getting into the milk, but not necessarily live, and it's not necessarily dangerous if it's pasteurized.
Well, not necessarily dangerous if it's pasteurized, and probably not dangerous if it's pasteurized. If it's not pasteurized, that same milk could be being sold and consumed is the same milk that's probably transmitting the virus when one cow goes into the milking parlor and leaves traces of virus through the milk for the next cow to be infected by. And so,
so
if
it's a kind of udder-to-udder infection, not necessarily respiratory or anything like that.
Yeah, it seems likely that this is mostly udder-to-udder and sort of a mechanical indirect transmission, but it's early days in our understanding, and so we still need to pin down if it is respiratory as well. We don't know that yet.
I mean, I was going to ask you about things we still need to know, but also I just want to check, when it's going from state to state, is that known to be associated with cattle movements, you know, people selling cattle across the country?
Again, that is still a big unknown. We do know that there's lots of state-to-state transport of lactating cows, and so I think that's very plausible and quite likely. But we are seeing this virus on the evolutionary tree. You can see that within this cattle H5N1 grouping, the branch on that family tree of the viruses, you are seeing the cattle virus move into birds like chickens, but also wild birds on farms that have cattle outbreaks are being infected. And so it may be that this is moving from the bird reservoir of H5N1 into cattle, and it's now a cattle outbreak, but movement farm to farm and state to state might be promoted by birds then moving it back into cattle.
And would that just be through, for example, bird feces on hay or something like that? I read a few weeks ago that the first introduction may have been through the fact that ground up bits of bird chicken carcass are fed to cattle, which I had no idea about. I mean, does that seem plausible, or could it be something as simple as bird poo?
Bird poo seems likely. I certainly am aware of this poultry litter, as it's called, being a possible way that this could have been introduced to cattle. I don't know the specifics of that to know whether that's a really viable hypothesis or not.
But presumably you'd like to know where it started.
Well, that's the whole thing, right? That's why getting these gene sequence data out early and trying to go back in time as far as we can to understand the specifics. You know, what state did this start in? What farm did it start in? Was there a poultry outbreak nearby? Were there wild birds that had the virus? Was it some other agricultural practice, though, that we can stop it from happening again?
The other bit of news this week, which I found very alarming, was this Centers for Disease Control report that on one farm in Texas, a whole load of cats had been infected through raw milk, which I guess they'd been fed by the farm owner, and half of them had died.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's not just birds that this is going from cattle to. It's going into other mammals, and at least in cats, it's showing this high pathogenicity that H5N1 is famous for. On the other hand, it's not killing a lot of cattle. It's pretty mild in cattle. It makes cattle sick for, 10 days or so, but then they get over it. And my guess, and again, this is just a guess, is that there have been many, many human infections with people working on the farm in close contact with the machinery that the virus is getting onto and so forth. And my hope is that in humans, this is not going to be a very pathogenic virus. And we do have one case of a putative dairy farm worker who we have the virus from. It's a sister group to the main cattle H5N1 lineage, but this guy definitely had H5N1. And with him, it seems to have been fairly mild. And so fingers crossed that that's going to be the general course of this and that it's not going to have the ability to transmit efficiently human to human.
I mean, we've been covering this H5N1 spread around the world now for certainly 18 months or so. And it's always seemed to me to be a problem for wildlife, a serious problem for wildlife, a problem for farmed animals and so on, birds. It seems to me that this is the first time when we have a potential route for repeated infections of humans if they're drinking, for example, raw milk.
Yeah, and so it's been a slow progression closer and closer to the scenario that you don't want to see, where first in Europe, this is clearly jumping into mammals and killing them on a sort of one-off basis. But then it's clear that this can transmit in mink, on mink farms. And then in South America, it gets into sea lions and seals and acquires mammalian adaptations that make it pretty clear that it's moving mammal to mammal. And that was concerning. But now we're at a new stage where we have a terrestrial mammal for the first time in history, and one, cattle, not known to be infected by influenza A virus previously. And of course, humans are in close contact with these animals and their products.
And from what you've been saying publicly, I think you're quite scathing about the nature of the response to this.
Let me put it in terms of how we can do better. That, as I mentioned, we have the technology to determine very rapidly, a single day's work can tell you what mysterious pathogen is causing an illness. And then we have the capacity to share sequencing information as it is generated on a sort of hourly, daily basis. Both of those things can put us in a position where the whole global scientific community is able to collaborate and see what they can see from pooled information and pooled analyses. And that is what we need to do if we're going to be serious about preventing the next pandemic. You don't want to find that the pandemic started 4 months previously. You want to be doing routine surveillance to find pathogens that are circulating in either animal or human populations when they shouldn't be there. And you want to catch it within days. And we have the technology to do that. It's a matter of investing the billions of dollars that it takes to do that seriously.
Geneticist Mike Warraby doing his best with what data the US agencies have released so far. I confess, I find it disturbing more data aren't being readily shared. If there was one lesson from the COVID pandemic, it was the need for scientific information to spread more rapidly than the virus. Another was how poorly the science of the virus mixed with politics. And the troubles of Professor Zhang Yongzhen of Fudan University in Shanghai bring those two problems together. At the very start of the pandemic, he got one of the first genetic sequences of the new coronaviruses. And because official channels refused to make it public, he shared his analysis without permission with virologist Eddie Holmes in Australia, who then shared it worldwide. The consequences for Professor Zhang were dire. He lost his employment and then full access to his lab. Protesting his eviction, he started sleeping at the Institute's front door last month, while a colleague took up residence in the lab itself. Eddie Holmes is on the line. Eddie, first, it was necessary, was it, for Zhang Yongzhen to share those data of the virus with you?
Yeah, hi, Roland. Yeah, I think it was absolutely critical. So once he got the sequence, we wanted to publish it. And so we told the Ministry of Health straight away what we had found. And we knew we wanted to get it out. But he was told in no uncertain terms not to publicize what he had found. Okay, I think that the authorities really wanted to control the message. And they said, don't publish, including that meant release the sequence. Now, we knew that that sequence would have been absolutely critical for the design of tests, so PCR-based tests. And that's why I really wanted to get out. And it turned out that within 48 hours of that sequence being released, Moderna had designed, using that sequence, the first vaccine. So it was absolutely critical that that was released as soon as possible.
And it took great courage, I guess.
Oh, he had to defy the authorities to do that. So it took great courage. It's quite a famous story now where he's flying from Shanghai to Beijing, and we talk on the phone. I ask him to release, can I release a sequence? And he says, I'll think about it and call you back. He calls about 1 minute later and says, as the plane is taking off, says, do it. And I do it. By the time the wheels touched down in Beijing and the sequence was out there, he's already in trouble. So it was immediate that the kind of pushback started.
And I mean, I hadn't appreciated that this was an ongoing issue. What was it that came to a head in the last month or so?
So it has been a very long and ongoing issue. And I've been reluctant to talk about it because I don't want to make it worse for him. And so he's trying to kind of navigate through a very, very complicated political space that we in the West probably don't really appreciate exactly how difficult it is. But what happened in the most recent past, he had an employment at this place called the Shanghai Public Health Clinical Center, which is in the south of Shanghai. But he was only ever given a temporary contract, despite all the work he's done. And that contract ended. And at the end of that contract, he was prevented from having any lab space. And he was also living on the campus for a while, and they basically evicted him. So he had nowhere to go.
He was essentially sort of squatting in his own lab to make sure he could get access.
So the campus has sort of like a hotel associated with it for patients and families who are getting treatment. And he was staying there, and they removed him from the they took stuff out of his apartment and sort of locked the door. They changed the locks, and they refused to let him into the lab. He then, as far as I understand it, he sued the Public Health Clinical Center for breaking their contract to him. And he lost that case in the last couple of weeks. And he told me by email he lost that case. And I think that has been the event that triggered this kind of protest that he took.
And I see this extraordinary picture of him sleeping on this doorstep, two police guards. I don't know if they're the official ones or they're there to protect him. I don't know. But it's an extraordinary picture.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible state of affairs for a world-renowned scientist who has been lauded for what he did, and he's won awards for that. Having to sleep outside the front door of his building is just an extraordinary thing to see.
How are things now? That's a couple of days I saw it.
Yeah, so I've been in contact with him a bit, and we just had an email exchange in the last few minutes. There's been a temporary fix. So I think he's allowed to go back in and do some work. So the kind of the severe sanction that was imposed recently has been lifted. But I think it is a temporary fix. I don't think that's by any means the last act in this drama. Zhang says to me that his troubles will continue. He made that very clear, and he will keep fighting. So this is a long running thing. And like I say, I think it started within hours of that sequence being released, and I think that because it broke what we were told to do, that has had these long running consequences. He's lost his health insurance, lost his pension, he's lost his research funds, he's lost his where he was living, and now he lost his lab. And it's been a horrendous slow crush of this person that's just extraordinary to watch. And as you said at the top of this segment, he's being punished for sharing All he's done is share the gene sequence of a virus that allowed people to develop tests against it and vaccines. It's just an incredible and very, very sad state of affairs.
And what worries me, Eddie, is that people are being punished for doing exactly what we want scientists to do, as you say, to share this knowledge. And, you know, as we've seen with this H5N1 thing, we're not learning stuff quick enough.
No, I completely agree. What really worries me about Zhang's case, other than what's happening to Zhang, which is a personal tragedy, is that anyone else in the same position will now think twice about sharing data. You know, if they do share it, maybe they'll suffer the same sanctions that Zhang has faced, which means they won't tell people and they will keep it to themselves. And every day that we don't act in a pandemic situation makes it worse. So it's just the worst possible signal we could have learned. And I think the same, as you mentioned in the H5N1, is that we've learned nothing about this.
Thanks very much, Eddie. And that's Professor Eddie Holmes of Sydney University, who's in London this week to receive the Royal Society's prestigious Croonian Medal for his work on pandemics and animal viruses, which has often underlined the risks of crossovers triggered by the way we invade and degrade the natural environment. A parable in the unexpected ways this might work came to my attention with observations in Uganda, which involve tobacco plantations, deforestation, dead wood, and the things that chimpanzees eat. Primate behaviourologist Pavel Federek of Stirling University was on the team that observed this strange chain of consequences. To start, the trees.
Many animals supplement their diet with items such as dead wood, which are likely less palatable and provide less calories than typical everyday food. However, we know that these items provide valuable minerals for healthy biological functioning, such as potassium, sodium, phosphorus, and other minerals, which are typically underrepresented in the normal diet of many forest-dwelling animals. And for Budongo chimpanzees in Uganda, a dead wood of a palm species called raffia used to be such a source of such important dietary minerals until this palm was nearly exterminated to dry tobacco leaves, then sold to international tobacco companies.
So this is really interesting. So the trees have two uses. One, effectively, minerals for wild animals. But secondly, somehow they're involved in tobacco production.
That's true. These local extinction of raffia palm deprived chimpanzees and other wildlife of important source of dietary minerals. And then since then, we observed chimpanzees and to other mammal species, black and white colobus, monkey and an antelope species known as red duiker, feeding on directly on bat guano, likely as an alternative source of minerals.
Bat poo you're talking about?
Poo, yes, bat poo, otherwise known as bat guano. And we know that they feed on bat guano most likely, almost certainly, as an alternative source of minerals, because we know from our own analysis that bat guano contains very high volumes of valuable minerals, including sodium, potassium, and phosphorus.
When you say you observed the chimpanzees and so on feeding on this, I mean, was this occasional or was this common?
So when we initially observed this behavior, we didn't know how common it is. And this is why we set out trail cameras. And then we recorded numerous instances of chimpanzees feeding on bat guano regularly. It looks like it's a common behavior now.
And sort of deliberate, do you think? It's not just that, I mean, they were definitely sort of picking up the stuff, handfuls or something.
We established that it wasn't accidental. They deliberately fed on guano by picking pieces of guano. So it wasn't an accidental behavior. It wasn't that they were drinking water next to it, because there was water next to it during the wet season. But that's not the case. They did drink water, especially the red duiker. But we also observed these animals feeding directly on the guano.
And just to, I don't want to be too grim about this, but this was sort of piles of the stuff somewhere?
Yeah, it was like a pile of bat guano under a tree hollow.
Where the bats would be roosting?
Where the bats would be roosting, exactly.
Okay, so that's there we got an extraordinary change of behaviour and quite a distasteful one. But the point is that we know that bats and so on can be sources of viruses and so on. We've talked a lot about that on the programme. And that was the other thing that you studied here.
Exactly. So we analysed the guano samples, not just for mineral content, but also what kind of viruses this guano heap contains. Because as you said, unfortunately, guano doesn't only contains these valuable minerals, but it's also full of viruses. And we know that recent outbreaks and pandemics, bats and bat viruses are implicated in these outbreaks. So once we observe this behavior, after this initial observation, it occurred to us that this is an important discovery because of that, because it has implications when it comes to our understanding of these early stages of outbreaks and pandemics, because we don't actually yet fully grasp the very early stages of virus spillover. But they are believed to involve such complex causal chains which are triggered by human activities. But,
and so what sort of viruses did you see in your analysis?
So in total, we found 27 viruses. Tony Goldberg from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a co-lead on this project, expert in epidemiology, he identified 27 viruses, and one of which being a novel beta coronavirus.
I mean, that's, for me, is so instructive, because there are so many ways we can be exposed to these viruses, it seems. I just find this so interesting. It's sort of unexpected, but the idea that because you're growing tobacco, you cut down a palm tree, that affects the way that some primate species behave, exposes them to bats and their viruses, and suddenly you have a route through to a new kind of infection. I mean, this isn't even your kind of research for real, but you must have been pretty surprised by it.
Exactly. So this is not my area of expertise. So we were all taken aback by what we discovered. And you mentioned about these cause-effect processes. This is how we interpret our findings. So what we are having here is so-called upstream drivers, such as socioeconomic forces, uncontrolled resources extraction, can initiate such cause-effect events or processes that ultimately increase the virus spillover risk. So I think that the take-home message here is, from our studies, that considerably more research is still needed to understand how human behavior, human activities can alter animal behavior in a way that exposes wildlife and humans to dangerous viruses.
Pavel Fedurek, the chain of events he described are detailed in Communications Biology. And that tale brings this edition of Science in Action from the BBC World Service to a close. Do join me, Roland Pease, and producer Alex Mansfield, same time next week, when I hope we'll have some more stories from the world of research.
Lives Less Ordinary brings you remarkable personal stories from across the globe, from people who've chased their dreams.
No one knew that I was going to travel by bike. If I had told them that I was riding a bike to Egypt, they might have said that it was impossible.
To people who've lived through nightmares.
Being in jail in Thailand, I made a promise to myself in that jail that when I'm home, I'm going to volunteer somewhere.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.